Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
Want to be nasty? Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiya yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país, tá? Nada, absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome to PALcast, a podcast by the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an effort to understand how law can be used to further, as well as to resist, autocratic forces that have been on the rise around the globe. You can learn more about the project at autocratic-legalism.net. PALcast is sponsored by the OU Center for Brazil Studies. Research and sound production for this episode were provided by Ahmed Abdelaziz. My guest today is Kim Lane Shepley. Kim is the Lawrence Rockefeller Professor of Sociology and International Affairs in the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs and the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. Her work focuses on the intersection of constitutional and international law, particularly in constitutional systems under stress. She studied the birth of constitutional law in Hungary and Russia following the end of the Soviet Union, the effects of the war on terror on constitutional protections around the world after 9/11, and more recently, she has focused on the rise of autocratic legalism in Hungary, Poland, the European Union, and several other places in the world. Among many titles and awards, Kim is an elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the International Academy of Comparative Law. Kim has a very special place in our project. She was the scholar who popularized the term autocratic legalism in law and society studies, and back in 2019, she gave a powerful speech at the annual meeting of the Law and Society Association, which she then presided, calling our attention to the ways in which law had become part of the toolkit of autocrats. PAL was born that day when a group of scholars in that audience decided to respond to her call. Because of her influence on our work, my plan was to have Kim on the show earlier in the season. But the day when we had the interview scheduled for, there was a big snowstorm in the United States, which left both of us without power and internet signal. It took a few months after that for us to first find our feet and then some time in common. But I'm glad we did, and I think talking to her was a great way to revisit lots of themes I had discussed with others and that became central to PAL's research agenda. Because we had so much to talk about, today's episode is a little longer than usual. But I swear to listeners that it's worth every minute of your attention, and I'm sure they will agree with me when they get to the end of it. Here's the interview. Kim Shepley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
You are a very special guest here at the podcast, as you know, because if you did not create the term autocratic legalism, you are the one who popularized it in the field of law and society. In 2019, when we still could have these massive in-person events, you gave this very powerful presidential address at the Law and Society Association annual meeting, which was based on this concept and which opened the eyes of your audience, where I gladly was, to a lot of what's going on in the world and the way law is part of it. And that's one of the features of a good concept, the capacity to draw people's attention to something that matters. But a good concept also needs to have some precision. People need to know what we are referring to when we use a concept. So I wanted to start this conversation today with your definition for the term. How do you define autocratic legalism?
Well, I'm not really big on definitions in general, because it seems to me that practices matter more than definitions. And so what I was trying to point to was a kind of family of practices through which somebody with autocratic aspirations uses the law to deconstruct the checks on their power. That's the primary use. But I also was curious about how, you know, it used to be that when democratic governments were overthrown, they tended to be overthrown by coup, right? So you get tanks in the streets, you mobilize lots of military people. And now when democracies fail, they fail because you get some charismatic leader who comes not with tanks, but with lawyers. And the lawyers go to work sort of shoring up the system through which the autocrat can never be removed. And so it's that use of law to create autocratic consolidation of power that I was particularly interested in pointing to. So it's not so much a definition as it is, you know, here's a family of practices that I think we should understand better.
Before you could formulate this, Javier Corrales referred to autocratic legalism as a set of tactics by which chief executives get to concentrate power, and that include the use, abuse, and non-use of law. It seems that your definition focuses not so much on this tactical relationship that new autocratic leaders have developed with law, but rather on the structural effects that it produces on governance to, as you say, keep the outer appearance of democracy and constitutionalism, but hollow out their liberal content. What makes this intriguing is that for the last decades, we were led to think of law as a cement that kept democracy and political liberalism together. What was wrong with this account, and how did law get to be used to undermine rather than to promote political liberalism?
I want to say that I did pick up the term from Javier Corrales, and I'm so grateful that he's let me borrow it. I've talked to him about it. And I think he was also interested in the same phenomenon. But I think that to some extent, when he defines autocratic legalism as the use, abuse, and non-use of law, I think he goes a little bit too broad, right? It just can cover everything, especially when you get to non-use. I mean, there's just an infinite supply of non-use. So I've tried to narrow it a bit while keeping his spirit. And part of it is to answer the question that you posed, which is that it used to be, and you know, many people in this audience may well have worked for democracy ratings agencies, you know, like Freedom House or VDEM, or been involved in some on-the-ground project where you're trying to figure out, is this a country under the rule of law? Or is this a democratic constitution in good standing? And frankly, what a lot of the democracy raters have done is to use the superficial appearance of the law. You can law on the books, right? To sort of use as a checklist. Now, you know, one thing that we do in law and society is we always say that law isn't just on the books, right? But it's law in action. And so what I think autocratic legalism points to is a case where the law on the books, at least if you read it, you know, sort of one law at a time, doesn't look too bad, sort of the way that Soviet constitutions kind of didn't look too bad if you just kind of read them without having any clue what they produced. And so what we're seeing now is that these laws are being used in such a way that they create something that I call in some of my other writings, a Frankenstate. You know, so you take, in fact, election law is one of the places where this happens all the time, where you take a rule from a system that is obviously not bad democracy, and you combine it with a rule from another not bad democracy, and the intersection of the two throws the election necessarily to one candidate in the context where you're doing it. So what happens, what democracy raters tend to do is they come in with a checklist. So did you have an independent commission drawing your districts? Yes. Did you have, you know, all these things? And then it turns out, well, if your independent commission is all stacked by political loyalists, it will look like an independent commission on paper, but it won't act like one. And then is there a way for courts to check, you know, whether the rules have been followed? And then you look at the election law and it says, and the appeals go straight to the Constitutional Court. So you say, great, yep, makes perfect sense. Unless you know that the Constitutional Court's been packed with loyalists for the government, right? So you can see how somebody would come in, read through the checklist, and first of all, not put together how the pieces work, And second of all, not look at how the practices work. Like, so what does it mean when this law goes into effect? So the liberal content is meant for democracy checklist people who come in and just say, I've recognized that law. I recognize this law. I recognize that law. Must be okay. Check. But underneath it, what's happening is an absolutely not liberal thing, right? Which is the concentration of powers in fewer and fewer hands. And that can be done while achieving this kind of superficial appearance. And I've called this the Frankenstate, because if you think about Mary Shelley's novel, you know, Frankenstein's the doctor, not the monster, as we always say. And Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein, goes out to the cemetery and he digs up these bodies and he sews together the torso of one with the arm from another and the leg from another. And what makes it monstrous is not that those pieces were bad in their original context, right? These were normal bodies. But when you connect them in a certain way, it produces this monster, right? So that's the image that I want to create, because the way you do that is normal body parts put together into this monstrous body politic.
And that gives illiberal politics a shell of liberal legality.
Finally. Exactly, exactly. And the reason why you need the lawyers is to preserve the shell of liberal legal legality. But the reason why you need particularly clever kinds of lawyers is to make sure that that shell is not filled with the content that goes with it, right? And that's what all these new lawyers have gotten really good at. And the problem is that once something works in one place, the autocrats in other places look to the first place and say, gee, they got away with it. Let me try that too. So you see this borrowing, and the borrowing or the migration of these ideas happens from very unlikely, you know, one very unlikely regime to another.
That is an aspect of your work that I find fascinating, that you conceive of autocratic legalism as a transnational phenomenon, where there is a diffusion of the models of legal reform being deployed by the new autocrats across national contexts. Before we dig deeper into this, which I want to do, can you share with the audience some examples of how this is happening?
So, for example, Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey decided he wanted to capture the constitutional court. He's one of these aspiring autocrats. He's, you know, really changed the constitutional system from parliamentarism to presidentialism to, you know, retain power for longer. Along the way, he went to pack the constitutional court. But he knows from looking, for example, at U.S. experience, that court packing is one of those things that gets the democracy raiders very upset. Like, they know that that's trouble. So Erdogan captured the court in two stages. First, he enlarged the jurisdiction of the court and gave it tons of small cases, all of which were important to the parties, but none of which would shatter his regime. So he floods the court with new cases, human rights cases, right? So at first he gets credit for like doing such great things for human rights. And then he says, wow, look at the overloaded court. They need more judges to handle this problem. So then he adds all these new judges to the court of his own choosing. And there you have a packed court in plain sight, where each step of it looks like he's supporting human rights in the judiciary, right? So he does this. A year later, Viktor Orban does the same thing in Hungary. And the reason why that's interesting is because Viktor Orban is known as Mr. Islamophobe, right? He's the guy who tried to prevent all those Syrians from coming into Hungary. And he was going on about Christian culture and how you can't have these mixing of populations. And yet his justice minister goes to Turkey on multiple occasions, I think to figure out how this was done, comes back and borrows something from the government of an Islamist political party. It just doesn't look like, how to put it, the only ideology they share in common is autocracy. There's nothing else in common about these guys but the political tactics and the result.
This is quite ironic if we think that for decades, a whole industry was set up to export the rule of law. And there were some scholars in law and society whose careers were, I would say, entirely devoted to analyzing how this industry worked and what impacts it produced or failed to produce. How can we track these movements of exportation and importation of illiberal legal reforms?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So It would be so much easier if they just formed like a Law and Society Association of the Dark Side, right? Then you could go to their meetings and figure it out. But they don't do that. So a lot of it, so far as I can see, from the ones where I've managed to trace the connections, are bilateral movements between, you know, justice ministries, from, you know, assistance to presidents and so on. So a lot of it seems to be done in bilateral mode. That said, and this is where, you know, this is a question I often ask myself as a, what's the responsible thing for a scholar to do? Like when I document these things, am I contributing to their spread? Because I say, hey, here's how it's done. You can read my book as a, you know, as a kind of guide to how to shut down a constitutional democracy. You know, so it's a kind of concern that by publicizing it, you give them ideas. You know, on the other hand, I must say they had plenty of ideas before I got there. So I think a lot of this is happening because the countries where autocracy is accelerating are kind of well known. And, you know, the folks who are interested in copying that pattern can go and look and see what was done. Because again, if all of this is done in law, laws are published. This is public stuff. Now, you know, there's a little problem of a language barrier and, you know, but still, I mean, as these laws are promulgated and as they're out in public, they are like a little library of autocratic habits. So so far as I can tell, there isn't a kind of central repository of bad ideas, but there certainly are models. And I might say just, you know, now that I think about it, so both Hungary and Poland have been going down this autocratic path quite quickly. And Hungary and Poland just announced that they are together forming something they call the Research Institute on the, Research Institute on the Rule of Law. And I think that's where they're going to hatch this stuff and support. I mean, it literally is a project that is designed to do surveys of European law on every question, so that when they are trying to accomplish something in particular, they can pick the Swedish rule on that and the Italian rule on this and kind of stick them together. So maybe this is an early institutionalization now that I think about it.
One question I have about this is whether what you're describing is completely new, or the history of liberal legality is one in which legal rights and procedures, maybe not always, but often, serve as a facade to arbitrariness. We see this, for example, in studies of the criminal justice system, or even in studies of access to civil justice. Before you started your journey in the realm of autocratic legalism, you also studied states of emergency and exception, from Germany in the 30s to the United States War on Terror. Are these two phenomena fundamentally different, or do they have similarities in terms of how law is used by those in power to suppress certain enemies of the nation?
You know, so first of all, is it new? No. I think that this is something that's been going on since the beginning of sort of constitutional separation of powers, that there are leaders who try to undermine the separation one way or another, sometimes by law, sometimes by assassination, you know, sometimes by putting in loyalists and sometimes by ignoring decisions of courts. So what's new about this is the engineered quality of it, that it's kind of built in before it's necessary. So it isn't a matter of just taking an existing system and deliberately misusing it, right? It's a matter of engineering it so that it logically produces these results. And I think that's come along with the general attention in both sort of constitutional law and law and society to constitutional drafting or legal engineering as kind of a subject, you know? And so all of that is, the dark side mirrors the bright side, so to speak. Right. So if we talk about engineering and we think about how do you engineer an ideal liberal, you know, constitutional order, there's going to be a dark side that says, and how do we crash it using the same means? You know, so I think in that sense, there's more deliberateness about it that I think is new.
I think that's a great point. We made law more central to and legitimating of governance at a time when liberal democracy was the only game in town. And when democracy backslides, autocrats have all the incentives to use that apparatus. It can be instrumental to what they want to do. It can also help to conceal what they're doing.
But the continuation of, you know, of terrorism and states of emergency, I mean, I feel like those were good things for me to study to prepare myself for this phenomenon. And I might say that the reason why I started studying states of emergency was because of 9/11, because you saw everywhere around the world, governments were doing the same things to, you know, suspend the operation of civil liberties, to create special courts and special tracks in the system for terrorists, special detention procedures, new secrets, new ways of pooling intelligence. I mean, there were a lot of things that were very similar. And what I was, the reason why I started studying it was that I had just spent, you know, 15 years studying kind of the end of the Cold War and what happened thereafter. And what was so striking was that what happened after 9/11 was the reverse of what I'd seen that happened after 1989. So just to give you one example. So in almost all the post-communist states, there was a big effort to take apart the ordinary police from the intelligence services because they'd been merged in the Soviet time. And after 9/11, the police are being merged with the intelligence services because there's this idea that we have to, quote, connect the dots, unquote. You know, and so you need all the intelligence to be located in one place. So what that told me at the time was, this is how you build an autocracy, because I'd just seen people dismantle them, right? And so you could sort of go on through a whole series of different kinds of changes. So, you know, one thing you do is that you create separate tracks for political cases. That was very common in the Soviet Union, where the ordinary courts were not as sullied as they might have been because political cases all went on a separate track. So what did we do? And after 9/11, they eliminated, after 1989, they eliminated all the special tracks and folded everything into one common criminal procedure. What happens after 9/11? Special track for terrorists, right? Anyway, I could go through a whole bunch of examples, but it looked to me like 1989 in reverse. So that's where the states of emergency idea and the stuff that I wrote about it was very much influenced by having watched the deconstruction of autocratic governments, watching them get reconstructed in democratic systems. And what many of us said at the time is that if this keeps going, it's very dangerous for the long-term survival of constitutional democracies. And indeed it has been, but not quite for the same reasons. So it's not because the anti-terrorism laws blew up and swallowed the democracy, although they've done plenty of damage and they're not repealed and they're still in existence, even though they were allegedly temporary and they're still doing damage. But instead it's something else, which is that the kind of persistent state of emergency weakened other institutions. So courts became used to exceptional measures and might have let down their guard in policing, you know, when governments were not following exactly the letter of the law. You had political candidates who would run on smash the terrorists, right? And then it became easy to smash other people, right? It coarsened politics in a way. I think it led to the undermining of the political parties that were supportive of the extreme anti-terrorism measures. And of course, more crucially, one of the things it did was it created a whole sphere of government secrecy in which it became possible to have all these unaccountable little groups fomenting trouble inside the government as well. So it created a kind of, it softened the ground for a lot of these autocratic moves. And when you had somebody who came in with autocratic ambitions, they could use the counterterrorism measures as a jumping off point for other things. You know, so for example, Viktor Orban created an anti-terrorism police in 2010 or 2011, actually. And you're thinking, wait a second, that's 10 years after 9/11. You know, you mean they didn't have one before? And he says, well, look, the EU says we should have, you know, special policing for terrorism. We're not following EU law. He sets up this anti-terrorism police. And then he gives it absolute surveillance powers with no checks at all. But the whole thing's hiding under the cover of anti-terrorism police. So that's a case where the 9/11 legal overreaction creates European laws that push countries toward establishing more robust anti-terrorism measures. And Orban accepts the invitation and creates essentially this unlimited surveillance operation. So they're all connected, you know. So like what that tells you is that constitutional democracies, once weakened, become easier to push over. You know, a lot of the checks, a lot of the defenses are gone. And especially if the autocracy can disguise itself as anti-terrorism, or in some cases, autocracy is disguising itself as anti-corruption, right? This is one of the Latin American tricks, right? You have some big movement to kind of fix democracy or fix constitutional liberal democracy by putting in place measures that wouldn't quite pass constitutional muster, except that they're for a really good cause. And then they become the door through which, you know, the autocrats, you know, push open the door, and suddenly you've got little seeds of autocracy everywhere. So I think this should warn us about loosening up the checks and balances, the respect for rights, not using special procedures, not using, you know, temporary laws, because all of that weakens the system and it becomes easier to kill off.
I know that you don't feel convinced by the use of the term populism to describe the leaders that you study in the ways in which they affect law. In your work, you say that while these leaders may adopt a populist rhetoric, that's more of a distraction, and what truly matters is the legal reforms that they are carrying out. Having a foot in the cultural analysis of law, however, I wonder if we shouldn't think that that rhetoric can be constitutive of legal reforms, that when somebody evokes a national identity based on race or religion or tradition in order to justify changes in law and constitutions, these changes are probably going to reinforce the symbolic primacy of that race, religion, or tradition that they are being enacted to protect. In your definition of autocratic legalism, is there room for this kind of inquiry? And if so, how does this potentially appear in your work?
So I don't deny that populism is a thing and that it matters and that it's concerning all by itself and that rhetoric can hurt. I guess what I want to say is that's not the whole story. I'm a little bit concerned about our law and society move from the study of practices to the study of rhetorics. Now, you know, I participated in that and I still believe in that. You know, how things are framed shapes what happens. So all that matters. The problem is you have to follow through to the how does the frame affect the shape, right? So one reason why we're getting a lot of this hateful populist rhetoric is that unfortunately, this is a way of winning elections. So the thing I perhaps didn't emphasize strongly enough is that the new autocrats are elected. You know, like I said at the very beginning, they used to come to power with tanks and by coup. Now they're actually elected often in free and fair elections the first time. And so the question is, how do they attract political support? And so the rhetoric that we think of as populist is one way of doing that. It's particularly concerning, but also unfortunately particularly effective when you get these politicians who break all the rules of rhetoric and say, you know, like a Bolsonaro, like a Donald Trump, who say the things that nobody could say out loud before, right? And that was designed to signal that they're not playing ordinary politics. I am a truly new face. I will really change things. It's a vehicle for coming to power. And it also is independently hurtful, right, of the people demonized and so on. So I don't want to say that that's not there. The problem is that much analysis stops there, right? And they think the problem is if you can just stop the terrible rhetoric, you will have solved the problem. And so when I say that the populism is a distraction, well, let me give you an example of how populism is a distraction. Again, I work most closely on Hungary, so I always have examples from there. So one of the hates just under the surface of Hungarian life is a deep antisemitism that has been there before, during, and after the Holocaust, which was particularly devastating in Hungary. And usually, you know, since 1989, when suddenly you could say anything, antisemitism has reared its head, and it's been, and the rise of the far right has sort of come along with that. Viktor Orban is too smart to put those words in his own mouth. So what Viktor Orban did after he came to power was that his cultural apparatus, you know, his culture minister, he has this woman who's like rewriting Hungarian history. They kept erecting statues to raving anti-Semites from the 1930s. You know, this author, this person who'd been a prime minister, not the worst ones, but pretty bad ones, right? So whenever one of these statues would go up, the entire left liberal opposition, which is not big enough to do too many things at once, would all race over to the other side of the city and demonstrate at the statue. And usually on the same day, in fact, it got to the point where I knew whenever I saw one of these statues going up, time to go look at what the parliament was doing when the opposition was off across the city protesting the statue. And so my slogan was, the statue hides the statute, right? So it was almost always on that day that the government was pushing through the parliament some law that would close off yet another avenue of liberal contestation, okay? And all the headlines on the newspaper would read the next day, raving anti-Semite gets a new statue, liberals opposed, right? And they'd ignore what happened in the parliament. It was so regular that, like I said, if I was busy and wasn't paying attention to the agenda in the parliament, if I saw the statue, I knew that there was a statue, you know? And so that's what I mean by distraction. And again, you know, whenever the government, whenever the people start to figure out what's going on, like, we're not going to be able to change this government through free and fair elections after this because the elections are no longer free and fair. Whenever that happens, the government puts up something that says, you know, pay no attention to what's happening in the parliament. You know, really what's happening is, and then they toss out some hateful line, which both, you know, obviously pumps up their base and also takes all the media attention away from the legal consolidation of power. So it's not that populism doesn't matter, but it matters on its own because it hurts people and it's terrible and it's hard to have an inclusive liberal, by which I don't mean left wing, but open and tolerant constitutional democracy with that kind of hate in the air. But it also, populism also accomplishes the feat of distraction from this stuff that's a little too hard to explain. So this is, especially when the statutes are complicated, it doesn't make for the headlines that statue to raving anti-Semite makes, you know? So that's why I'm afraid that we look at populism, we academics are so enamored of discourse because we can study it from our desks and we don't look at the practices. So that's law and society point one. And then law and society point two is we stop there and we don't look at what's actually happening because law is the state in lots of ways. And you'd think we'd know that as law and society people, but we also have to look at what the law is doing to keep power from moving to new hands.
Your main piece so far on autocratic legalism ends with a recommendation that we teach ordinary people how to recognize signs of danger. You write, and I love this, that law is too important to leave only to the lawyers, and that a citizenry trained to resist the legalist autocrats must be educated in the tools of law themselves. Am I right to assume that you're suspicious about the capacity of legal professionals and institutions to resist autocratic legalism?
So this is such a good question. So this is where lawyers have a responsibility that many lawyers have not yet taken up. And that is, you know, we all know, again, this is socio-legal studies 101, that lawyers want to, shall we say, preserve the ability to monopolize who gets to say what the law is and what it means to the profession. And that means that in most countries, it's very hard to learn the law, you know, and that lawyers look down on this and that, you know, if you study law at university, then that's one thing. Okay, you can be initiated into the tribe and we'll tell you that you have to keep this close to yourself because if you explain how the law works, there won't be a need for lawyers. You know, so it's part of the monopolization of lawyer of legal knowledge serves to boost the position of lawyers in any society. That's the professions are all about that, right? It's a lot easier for doctors to do that, where there's a lot of science and math in between a general public and what they're doing. But where it's just words, especially fancy words, it doesn't look as difficult for a general public to understand as some of the other bases of professional knowledge. So lawyers, I think, go to great lengths to keep the public from knowing the kind of stuff that would enable the public to replace them. And what that's done is it's created a legally ignorant citizenry. And a legally ignorant citizenry is a vulnerable citizenry. And one hopes that, of course, the lawyers spring up and come to the defense of constitutional democracy And in some places like Poland, for example, or like in Pakistan when the courts were being shut down, or like in Egypt, where you've seen people go to the streets and they have these signs like defend our courts, we love judges, or, you know, we love lawyers. That's really impressive, but it doesn't happen everywhere. And oftentimes the legal profession learns to go along with politics because, well, it's the politics that produces their law, you know? So we need to rethink how the legal profession thinks of its responsibilities. The legal profession is crucial to the maintenance of constitutional democratic systems. But the only way that they can responsibly defend those systems is if they get more defenders, which is to say, if the public that votes in elections starts to recognize when constitutional democracy is under attack. And in particular, the lawyers have to educate people in how to distinguish populism from autocracy, which is to say, how to distinguish the political issues that get them angry enough to go and vote from the rules of the game, which need to be defended, you know? And so what that's going to mean is that lawyers are going to have to give up some of their monopoly in order to preserve the very governments that give their profession a reason to exist. You know, they have to take a bigger view that unless publics are educated in what it would mean to defend a constitutional democracy and to recognize the legalistic moves being done to dismantle them, that the democracy is just vulnerable, right? And the legal profession is really crucial in making sure that doesn't happen. So, you know, I hope that one of the things that will come out of this is that we can persuade lawyers that their real strength lies not in keeping all legal knowledge to themselves, but in empowering citizens to become better citizen lawyers when it comes to defending constitutional democracy. And so, you know, this is what I hope. We used to run, when the new constitution was formed in Hungary in 2011, I worked with some local civic groups to do like education in the public square on the new constitution, where we just did like citizen education drives. And I wish it had a bigger effect, but, you know, it's that kind of thing we need to do as one way to alert publics to what is happening.
Like many others who study democratic backsliding, you were also vocal about the Trump presidency and what you saw as his disposition to cling to power and to weaponize law with that purpose. Trump is out, but it's undeniable that he put the U.S. democracy and the rule of law under great distress. Why did he fail? Why did he go so far? And what is needed to make the U.S. democracy more resilient against Trump likes?
Yeah, so we're all I mean, Trump is going to come back. And if we don't use this time when he's out of power to prepare for the next time, to learn the lessons of the first time, the U.S. is in real trouble. So how did Trump get as far as he did? Well, he got as far as he did through populism, right? Which is to say, exactly the rhetoric of hatred and the rhetoric of being the bad boy, right? Like, I will break all the rules. I will do, like, you know, I will not do conventional politics. And he got a lot of supporters for that reason. But we got lucky in Trump's first term that he had no idea about law. So if you remember, he at first tried to ban like all Muslims from coming to the US, and he just set it up in a legal way that a first year law student could figure out what was wrong with it, right? So it was bad lawyering. They try to fix it after the fact. But for the first couple of years, Trump didn't do anything that was lasting damage except for the hateful rhetoric and its effects, right? Which was plenty, but still. Underneath it, the constitutional democracy wasn't assaulted. Well, yes, it had assaults, but you could come back from it. What happened was that, in fact, it was around the state of emergency that Trump declared to build his border wall, that he suddenly discovered law. And he issued a state of emergency. He followed the procedures in this thing called the National Emergencies Act to do so. And a reporter called me up and said, what's the most striking thing about Trump's state of emergency? And I said that he had a good lawyer that he listened to. And from that moment on, once he got Bill Barr in at Justice Department as the Attorney General, suddenly the Trump administration became far more dangerous because they attached this populist rhetoric to the autocratic driver of the system. And so a fair amount of damage was produced. And of course, as we all know, I mean, the biggest damage what were the attempts to rig and overturn the election itself and to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. So that was a big shock to a lot of people. So now the question is, can we Trump-proof the system for next time? And here, I just want to say, another reason to separate populism from autocracy is to say, politics is about disagreements and fighting. I'm not talking about getting a president I like, right? I'm not talking about getting a president whose policy prescriptions would be my favorite. I'm talking about getting a president who will not crash the Constitution, which is a different conversation. So that's why I try to separate them. So what can we do? Well, there are a lot of groups hard at work trying to do things. And it turns out not to be so easy, because what the system of separation of powers that we have in the United States presupposes that Congress will check the president, that the courts will check the president, that each institution has an institutional responsibility to stand up to the concentration of power. But what we have now is what some of my colleagues have called not a separation of powers, but a separation or non-separation of parties. So that the Republicans in Congress uphold the Republican president, the Republican judges vote for whatever the Republican president wants. When you get that kind of alliance, which we have to large measure in the US now, the checks that we built into the constitutional system against autocracy disappear. So how can we bring them back again? Well, you know, one thing to do is to get what you need are parties that actually want to uphold the Constitution. And we literally have a political party now for whom the destruction of the Constitution would be considered a big political success. And that's the danger. So we have to think about how to get a sane conservative political party. I think of the most urgent task in American politics is to find honorable conservatives, which sounds weird. It's not to push my agenda because I'm not on that side of the political spectrum. But the fact is that, you know, we won't have a chance to ever have that political argument that we could win at an election if you don't have somebody sane to argue with. So we need to think about things like voter protection, how to keep elections free and fair. The Republicans are pushing through all this legislation that puts elections into the hands of partisans who will overturn and to give them excuses to overturn reasonably conducted elections on pretextual grounds. That's hugely dangerous. That has got to be issue number one to stop. You know, thinking about how to produce checks on a Republican president, can we try to get better, like train the Republican lawyers to do what the JAG Corps did after 9/11, the lawyers who work in the US military, who when they were given orders to torture detainees, said, that's a violation of the Geneva Conventions. No, that's why the CIA got the job, because they didn't have that kind of protection. So we need to work on the legal profession. We need to work on the apparatus of voting and elections. And we have to think about how to put more checks in power. So here's where the fact that the Republicans control the court system with partisan Republicans is so worrisome. You know, we've seen that capture in other places. And once that happens, very hard to roll back. So do we need to expand the judiciary? Or do we need what I proposed recently to the US Supreme Court Presidential Commission, was that we have a congressional override of presidential vetoes. Maybe we need a congressional override of Supreme Court decisions that ground their interpretations in the Constitution. Maybe we need to add some more checks and balances to the system so that it can't be captured by one political party. We used to worry about it being captured by one branch. That's not the problem. The problem is being captured by one party. So now we have to rethink what that means. So voting rights, we start with trying to figure out how to get the courts to be alarmed about these developments and how to overturn decisions that are power concentrating decisions is sort of my second priority.
You study these strong men, and they are all men, and publicly criticize their projects and actions. What is it like to be in that position? Do you fear for your safety? And how do you ensure your safety and the safety of your collaborators?
Well, yeah. So unfortunately, we live in a world of death threats, you know, and the vast majority of them are probably not serious. But since I've done a lot of this work in Hungary, I get death threats. I'm trolled. My phone's been bugged. Some of my research collaborators have been beaten up on the streets and left for dead in Hungary. One of my collaborators some years ago spent 2 weeks in the hospital after being beaten up by thugs. And it's hard to say it was because he worked with me, but you know, broad daylight on a major street in downtown Budapest, you get beat up. And then when you report the thing to the police, they say, oh, the security cameras just happened to be off that day. You know, it didn't look good. So I do think we have to worry about safety, those of us who work on this stuff, depending on the how much damage we're doing to our opponents and what kind of resources they have at their disposal. So I do a lot of, you know, secure communications. There are platforms and internet methods that don't allow you to be hacked. I don't go to Hungary anymore. And the last time I went, I was met at the door of the plane by 6 uniformed police who didn't touch me, didn't arrest me, didn't say anything, but they made a little circle around me as I was in the airport. All the other passengers were looking at me like, what did she do? You know, they just use intimidation tactics. So here's the good news about studying autocratic legalism. They publish their laws, and that's where it is. You don't need to go into the country to do it. Now, it helps to interview people, and I do that through secure methods because it's not so much me. I don't think they're going to, I'm too visible, and I'm too far away from them. But what I don't want is for the people that I work with after that one episode to come in, the ones who are sort of under their jurisdiction. So I think we have to be careful about who our collaborators are. I think we need to take reasonable security measures. But the whole point is that they're trying to put us off studying it. And that's the thing we cannot do. We can't stop doing this because we're getting threatened. And, you know, unfortunately, research is now a contact sport. And what I tell everybody who's about to go start work on this topic is just be prepared for that. Don't be shocked when it happens and think a little bit ahead about what you need to do to guarantee your own security. Think about whether they would really do it, because a lot of what they do is just, you know, rattle you with the threats.
And I imagine that being a woman makes things a lot worse for you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So it's gendered threats. So you're threatened not just with being killed, but with being raped. The Hungarian government-friendly press would publish these cartoons of me, which were, shall we say, rather gendered in the kind of insults and injuries that they imagined they would inflict on me. When I was first started on this, because Orban came back to power in 2010, and I was really on the visible in 2011, 12, 13, as Orban was just starting down this path and nobody else had noticed, the European Commission started to notice. And the person at the European Commission who had this portfolio was a woman named Viviana Reding, and they did the same to her, you know. Not to, you know, José Manuel Barroso, who was president of the commission, who also attacked them. None of that gender abuse. But for Viviana Reding and for me, in fact, when I finally met her in person, I said, it's so nice to meet the person that I see, you know, looking like me in the Hungarian press with all of the terribly gendered cartoons, shall we say. So, yeah, there's definitely a gender component. And you might notice that in many of these autocratic regimes, there's a gender component to the populism too. I mean, Orban, the Hungarian government just submitted its statement to the, you know, it's doing the universal periodic review in the UN human rights process. And it just submitted its statement to the, you know, secretariat. And what they said was, well, we didn't sign on to the Istanbul Convention on Violence Against Women because we object to, quote, gender ideology. Right. So, you know, there's a big gender piece of this in the right wing populisms. And but again, you can't be distracted by the rhetoric. You got to look at what they do.
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you to, as I like to say, open up your library and tell us what are the 3 key readings that you would recommend to our project and audience.
There's so many, right? So the question is how to limit it to just a few, because there's a whole industry of sort of democracy doomsday books, right? So You know, I think that first out of the blocks was the Levitsky and Seiblatt book called How Democracies Die, which I wish were more legal. I think my big criticism of that book is that I think it's kind of altogether too legal, you know.
I'm hoping to bring Levitsky to the show on season two, and that is a question I have for him.
Good. So, I mean, they sort of think it's all about norms and soft, what we would think of as soft law. And if it were all soft law, it would be so much easier to overturn, right? When you try to roll this stuff back. So I think if that book were more legal, that would be great. Then there's Balint Magyar's book called The Post-Communist Mafia State. It's very specifically about Hungary. But what's striking about that book is that he shows how autocrats pressure their subjects into compliance by economic measures. You know, so nice business you had there would be really a shame if something happened to it. And then there's a law that does that kind of thing, right? Or that people are fired from their jobs and then blacklisted so they can't get a job anywhere else. Or the Hungarian government doesn't like Central European universities, so they pass a law, applies, you know, nominally to all universities, but it only has the effect of throwing out this one university, and on and on. So what the post-communist mafia state argument does more broadly, and that I think would be interesting to apply to other countries, is to look at the way in which autocrats, under the cover of general law, single out people. This is the old argument in US law about bills of attainder, as we call them in the Constitution, laws that single out specific people. The autocrats have gotten better about writing laws that look very general, but that single out specific enemies for bad treatment. And that book really, I think, documents very well how that happens. My colleague Jan Werner Müller just came out with a book called Democracy Rules. And it's rules in two senses, right? Like, so how does democracy actually govern? And what are the rules you need to have a democracy? So like Seiblatt and Levitsky, Jan Mueller thinks about, so what are the essential elements of democracy and what do you have to preserve to maintain one? His is a little bit more legal, but it's more political theory-ish and less comparative politics. So it goes to the question of sort of what would it take to have a kind of better democracy, a shored up democracy. And there, it seems to me, it's something that those of us who work on law need to think about, because what many of us want to do is fix everything in constitutional rules. But while we're doing that, we need to leave space for legitimate contestation, because democracy is nothing if there are no choices, right? So the question, and I think Jan is pretty good at thinking about, what do you do constitutionally and what do you leave open for democratic publics to decide? So I guess I'd pick Jan Mueller's Democracy Rules.
That was Kim Chapley. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, and I wish I could talk to everybody who's going to hear this.
If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions regarding the series or our project, feel free to contact me at fabio.isaiasilva@ou.edu.